Welcome to the FinTech Scaling Show. This podcast is sponsored by the Growth Platform Framework. B2B FinTech startups accelerate customer acquisition and set up business operations to scale systematically. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@ipractitioners.com. Now, over to the show with Richard Dosey, founder and host.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Today on the show, we have Azmat, co-founder and co-CEO of Fortu Wealth over here in London. Prior to co-founding Fortu, Azmat has had a stellar career in investment management and M&A, which has spanned across the UK, Switzerland, Turkey, and also parts of Russia. So yeah, really, really excited to have him on the show today. Hey, Azmat.
Hi, Richard. Thank you. Thank you for such an intro. I feel humbled.
Let's kick off the show. Maybe we can sort of go back in the time machine a bit and look at the early part of your career, as I've just mentioned. And maybe you could give us insight as to how this has helped you in your success at Fortu.
Sure. So my career started back in 2008. I started working in investments. I started with real estate investments. Then I switched to more of operational management of the private equity project for the ultra high net worth investor. And then basically for the whole my career until Fortu, I was working with ultra high net worth investors in different roles, starting from operational management, then moving to more of an advisory role, investment management, then as an investment advisor, chief investment officer, and investment committee chair. So I worked in all of these roles, and that obviously helped me to understand the industry, asset management industry, private banking industry, wealth management industry. So that experience dealing with investors on one end and dealing with the deal flow of various asset classes on the other end obviously gave me a lot of opportunities to learn. And I was at the same time improving my academic skills. So I did MBA and I did Masters in Finance in London Business School, because I haven't had the conventional career of in investment banking or any big investment gig. I had more of a DIY experience, I can tell you, working directly with investors. And that's why a lot of things I think I learned from working with the actual projects. And the most exciting journey, I would say, started with my co-founder Firdaus about 5 years ago, started Jefferson Capital. It's a boutique asset management firm. So it's our own firm where we brought in all the clients and relationships that we known. But very quickly, we realized that business, even though it's very profitable and interesting, but it's really difficult to scale. Because we are limited to the availability of the time that we have, myself and him. As ultra high net worth investors, they don't want to talk to any junior people. They want to talk directly to the beneficiaries of the business. So, and we're limited by the number of people we can talk to during the day. So the reason we started Fortu, because we realized that private banking industry, you know, will have to change, and there will be new digital solutions which will be more fitted to the needs of the millennial high net worth and ultra high net worth individuals, as the need of private banking is also changed. I think historically, as you know, private banking was more about sort of secret accounts in different jurisdictions which people were hiding or having plan B in Switzerland. But now it's changed. As you know, we live in a very transparent world with the common reporting standard. All the information are transparent now. So now the private banking is mainly about the service. So people go for private banking services only, and they're happy to pay a lot of money for this service only if they get exclusive service, if they get exclusive investment opportunities. And unfortunately, still the industry is focused on a traditional business, on paper-based business focusing on the generation of baby boomers rather than the generation of millennials who are growing in numbers in terms of the numbers of ultra high net worth individuals from that generation. Sorry for the long intro.
It's like a monologue. Awesome. I think we can just stop there. You know, Greg, that's absolutely amazing background there. And maybe let's dive into a couple of topics that you you mentioned there. And I'll start sort of right at the top. I love it when you said I had a DIY experience.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Sure, definitely. Basically, we had two co-founders. My co-founder had more of a conventional career. He started his career in banking. He worked for EFG Private Bank. Then he worked with WMG Wealth Management Group. And he was always in more of a employed traditional background. And my experience was never a traditional conventional career. Rather, I was always in a more of a self-employed consultant role, entrepreneurial role. And I never imagined myself in a fully employed sort of traditional environment, corporate environment, because of my character, because I never could have imagined myself. And when you don't have that background, you have to be DIY. So you have to learn because you don't have a proper, inductions, trainings, corporate experience. So you have to learn things yourself. You have to learn from others, those who have that experience. And I was very lucky and I'm grateful to a lot of people who helped me along the way because they gave me the shortcuts and taught me a lot of things and saved me from a lot of time waste and mistakes because I learned a lot of from people who already had experience. And I was lucky to work at the level of ultra high net worth individuals. So I learned a lot from my clients, investors who I work with still. And that gives you a lot of lessons, I would say.
And learning lessons, I guess, on the job, you know, it's gold dust, right? And what type of lessons did you find the most valuable looking back on it now?
There are a number of them, but I can give you a quick example. I remember back in 2014, I was working with one of the investors that I know that we are in touch with now. And he had an idea. He had the vision that he wants to build a venture capital fund back in the time. But we didn't know where to start because he didn't have any contacts. I didn't know that industry that much. So what I did was I just bought a ticket to San Francisco from London. I flew there. I visited 3-4 events. I remember the first one was the launch by Jason Calacanis. Then there was, I think, Startup 500 and the YC event. So I visited all of those events. I built a network of people. I got to know how the industry works. So that's the example. Basically, you dive into it. You find the opportunities yourself if you don't have any. And then we've managed to build what he wanted, basically, based on that experience.
Great self-taught lessons. And just going back to Jefferson Capital, you mentioned that one of the reasons that you moved towards sort of setting up 42 Wealth was Jefferson was, you know, in your words, difficult to scale.
Yeah.
I mean, how far into the journey did you come to realize this?
So basically, we merged the books of clients, myself and my co-founder, and we have now about 12 high net worth under the same roof. But the problem in this business is that in order to acquire client, it's quite a lengthy process. So the sales cycle, if you can use that traditional metrics, in this business is really long. It can take 2-3 years because you build a relationship. Because private banking is more about relationships. You build the relationship of trust with the client, and that can take years because it's more like building a friendship with someone. It's not when you try to push sell a property, or something quickly, and they know that you're trying to sell and you know what you're trying to get. In these dynamics, when you in private banking space, you're building relationships first, and then that converts or yields into the actual business. But it takes time, and we quickly realized that we are in this business for how many I mean, I was working with Ultra High Net Worth for 12 years and Firdaus for, I think, 14 years, so even longer than me. And we realized that quite quickly. And we realized that the main value is the time, because you spend exactly the same amount of time with the client who is bringing you 100 million and with the client who is bringing you 1 million. In terms of the time spent and in terms of the relationships and the effort you take is the same. So that's why we thought that in order to scale, you need to have a digital solution. And it's not only about wealth management, it's also about other services, because a lot of processes in private banking now are done manually. For example, when clients are doing high value payments, when clients are doing any investment transactions, everything is done manually. Instructions are sent via email. Client has to receive a phone call. It's still very manual and old fashioned. We think that that's inevitably change, because we are now in the era of the accelerated digitalization in all areas of our life. And obviously, private banking will be one of them. And also, we started talking and interviewing clients, and they told us that they feel that private banks are still in the 20th century, that they're not up to date, because they tried all the new neobanks, like Revolut, Monzo, Starlink, and they see the difference that private banks are still paper-based. They try to do the apps, but they can't, they don't work, they never work. And that's the opportunity we saw, because we thought that if they're falling behind, then we should definitely try to innovate in this particular space and meet the demand of the clients.
So I guess that's, the problem you're trying to solve is digitizing the private banking world, right?
Yes.
And then another layer is making certain that it's accessible not only to baby boomers and the like, but, you know, the millennials.
Yes. Another thing is that actually millennials and Generation Z, they don't understand private banking. A lot of people ask me, well, what is private banking? Because they know traditional conventional banking. They know, I don't know, Revolut. They know trading apps. They know apps for the FX conversions. So there are a lot of apps, like cryptocurrency apps, but they don't know what is private banking. What is it for? So I would like to explain just a little bit, because I guess there will be a question like, why do you need private banking if you have all of that already on the market? So the explanation is quite simple. I can give you an example of our clients. For example, when they try to use Revolut or any other conventional, I don't know, neobank, app-based bank, they face a challenge of making high-value payments. And in their sort of standard transactional pattern, they would make a payment of 50 or 70,000 in a go. For these apps, these payments are considered to be very high risk, and they're always frozen. And you have to wait 5 to 7 days in order for it to get resolved. And you have to wait in a queue with the chatbot in order to get it resolved. And for these kind of cases, you have private banking experience. When you don't have this and you have another person on the line, you can call and he's always available for you and he can get it resolved if there is a question like that. But ideally, there wouldn't be any question for high value payments, providing you did the initial source of wealth verification on the onboarding. So if bank knows that this client is a high value client and for him that the transaction pattern of 50,000 is okay, then there won't be any issues. But for the traditional retail business, like traditional neobanks, the average account size, the balance on the account in neobanks is below 250 pounds, which means that for them, 50,000 is a very big abnormal transaction.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent explanation
of
how it all fits together, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit different risk model, because the risk model and the compliance engine that neo banks use is more about automated algorithm. So it's a tick box approach. When something is above that tick box, it's frozen for 5 to 7 days. And in private banks, it's always more of a qualitative approach. So they would do a qualitative onboarding of the client. Onboarding, for example, forms in private banks are about 100 pages long because they want to know everything, like your grandmother, the name of your dog, everything.
Yeah, the more information on a client, the better, or a customer, the better nowadays, right?
Yeah, and it helps them not for the marketing purposes, but rather to make sure that they understand the nature of the wealth, where the money is coming from.
Yeah.
Because the compliance needs to be confident that this money is legit, it's all taxable, the source is legit, so et cetera, et cetera.
That makes sense. And listen, I've got to ask you, so obviously we're creating a digital app here for sort of the private banking world, but we're also looking at Gen Z and millennials, and they aren't fully educated on what private banking is. So how have you guys approached that? Is there some sort of education, communication going out into the community?
The way we approach it, we basically explain them the convenience and time-saving element of it and transparency. Also, traditional private banking industry is not known for transparency, especially when it comes to fee structure. People still use private banks and they don't understand because it's really complex fee structure. Like they have foreign brokerage fee, transaction fee, custody fee, all kind of fees bundled, and you will not notice how much you're paying in reality. And that's one of the challenges that we see when it comes to millennial or Generation Z trying to use private bank because they hate non-transparency. Or not when it's not clear what you're paying for. And because they got used to subscription-based business, when it's like you pay for your Netflix or for your Spotify, and you know how much you charge per month. And it's one flat fee. So that's the same model that we're trying to apply. So we're trying to apply a subscription fee as a basic model and one fee only, so there are no more additional fees. And we're trying to focus on the convenience and time-saving value for them because time is the most valuable asset for this generation because they, for example, when they try using something what is not user-friendly and they give up at, I don't know, third minute of clicking the button because they cannot get through and they just forget about it because it's taking too much time. So our idea is to make it as user-friendly as we can so they understand the value of time saved and the convenience that they can get out of using our solution rather than using multiple solutions anywhere else.
And it sounds like there's lots of different nuances in sort of in your customer hypothesis. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering how you guys approached product market fits, what steps and processes you went through to validate?
I would say that we're still ongoing because we are a seed stage startup. We just raised the seed money and we're still validating the hypothesis. One of the challenges for now for us is that we have the MVP up and running, but it's for payments only. The wealth management side of the business is still not launched. So we are A/B testing some ideas now and we are preparing to roll out the wealth management element of the business. And that would take some time because there are obviously some regulatory requirements that we have to meet before we go live on that. And we need to make sure that it all works as we want it. So that will take some time. And only after that, I can tell you that we went through the product market fit exercise. But for now, I mean, what I can tell you is only from the interviews, custom interviews that we had, and we had a lot of them. Before starting this business, obviously, we did a lot of customer interviews, a lot of surveys, a lot of online tests that helped us to understand if we are moving in the right direction or not.
That makes sense because you get validation and feedback on a continuous basis before you actually launch into something, right?
True. And it's an ongoing process. I can tell you that every week we learn something new and every week we tweak and change. So our chief product officer is like learning every week something new from the customers and we learn a lot. And I think it's a beauty of being a startup that you can change things on the go and have this flexibility of changing things rather than when you're a big corporation and you need to go through tens of approvals and months of paperwork, right?
Yeah, exactly. You need to be dynamic, definitely, and respond to sort of market needs, right? And as you, I guess, going through the motions and, you know, you've got the payments part of the business going, you're just about to, or hopefully very soon, get the wealth management part of the business going. How are you guys setting your structures up to make certain that you continue along that path of developing great products continuously and quickly getting them to market?
I would say it's the team. We focused on growing a very good professional team. One of our values, corporate values, is the team first. So we understand that in this business, in a startup world, it's all about execution. So if you are, regardless of your idea, if you have a great A team, I think you can achieve anything and you can pivot and change your ideas on the go multiple times. No one is restricting you, but I'm focused on building the team. So we both, me and Firdaus, we every day doing interviews. Every day we are interviewing new people and trying to get the team together. Now it's a bit challenging with COVID, obviously, because to build the corporate culture and to sort of build this team spirit, you need to be in one place, ideally. It's much easier to build it physically. But if you are working remotely, it's much more difficult and challenging, but we're trying our best to do that.
And when you say building the team, tell me more about that. Well, what parts are you focusing on? Or are you just focusing on building the broad spectrum of the team, i.e. COO world, CFO world?
So for now, I think it's important to know that we had the last three C-level hires, which were very important additions since the new year. And we also decided on a strategic move to have a sort of a second office where the developers will be sitting in one place rather than having them spread all across the globe and sitting in Zoom. We decided to put them in one place, and we think that that would help us to build this corporate culture and the right sort of values. Another move that we did was we invested in education. So we teaching, for example, from technological point of view, we're using Golang as a main programming language. Mm. So we invested in the Golang Academy to teach young, talented programmers who want to learn Golang. And it's more of an educational program with the further employment, so we can choose the best employees for ourselves. Even though it would take them about a year and a half to get to the more senior level, but still it's an investment, a smaller investment that we can do now in order to, which will yield in the higher, because now it's a time of hunt. Everyone is hunting for professionals, for developers, for the talent. And we decided to build this in-house rather than, again, hiring people. And because if you are able to build this in-house, you will have a homegrown talent which will be loyal to you, and that will help you to build the corporate culture around your brand as well.
Yeah, some salient points there. And tell me more about your thinking about moving all the devs into one location and one, maybe it sounds like one office block.
Yeah. So the reason for that is because, as I mentioned, because of COVID, everyone is working from home, and we had that challenge of building this culture remotely. Obviously, we have our team here in Canary Wharf in level 39. The main team is here, the C-level and senior developers who are responsible for the main sort of production version. But those developers, like designers who work with us remotely, we decided to put them in one office because we think that it will help, again, to build this culture and to have them long-term committed to work with us rather than having this challenge of keeping the team together. In terms of, it just, it's a challenge which I see for any new venture. Because if it was established business for a long time, probably they wouldn't be such a challenge in the remote work world. But now I think for a new startup, it's a challenge. And I think a lot of people would agree with it, those who are starting the business now.
Yeah, I can see it. I mean, a number of other, you know, guests that I've had on the show are facing similar sort of challenges as they scale up, not just their dev team, but just, you know, their whole organization. I think you're right, culture, build relationships is another thing, right? Face-to-face provides that, right?
Yeah. I'm trying to challenge that. I mean, we're trying to have a lot of calls, team calls, face-to-face calls, but still, it's something which you get when you see people, when you go for a beer with the people, when you just build the relationships, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, exactly. And I also know you guys have recently gone through some funding. You just mentioned it early on. How have you approached this part of your growth story? What platforms and or other tools have you looked to help you along the funding journey?
Sure. So initially, we didn't want to do any crowdfunding because obviously working with high net worth and ultra high net worth investors, we had a lot of offers on the table in terms of investments. And it was not the main reason we went for crowdfunding. And the main reason was primarily in embracing the transparency, because crowdfunding is a challenging experience. You receive like hundreds of questions from a lot of people, and they try to challenge your vision, try to challenge what you're doing, asking a lot of questions. So we went through that deliberately because we wanted to embrace transparency. As again, private banking is not about transparency, but if we are to disrupt that market, we need to take a different approach. And that's the reason we went for crowdfunding. Also, building a community. So now we have about 1,000 people who know about us, at least those who pre-registered with us, left the emails, who are interested in Fortune. We have about 600 investors who invested in us. I think it's much better than having one or two family offices which just passively not interested in you, right? We just give money and forget about you. This community is something very valuable for us, and we're building that community by organizing monthly events. So we have monthly sort of Fortune investment discussion club where people can participate. They build the community around the brand, which is really important for the marketing long term.
Tell me more about that community. I know we talked about brand, we talked about also having those events. Why else do you think it's important to you guys to build a community of individuals that you want to engage with, you know, month in, month out?
I think that for the business that we are in, for the private banking industry, that's the main strategy how you can grow. You build the community of people, and it's word of mouth. So if you are moving in the right direction, you will attract more and more people who are interested in what you're doing. And it has to be organic and natural. So you cannot push sell what you're doing. And I know it because in investment world, you see there are so many services and providers which offer you to get rich quickly. And for professional investors and high net worth and ultra high net worth investors, they don't react to that anymore because they see it so much. And usually those who react are not our target audience because it's like buying a lottery ticket for them. So they want to get rich quickly. But wealth management and private banking is not about getting rich quickly. Rather, is about managing and investing your money in a smart way, which will give you a decent income, capital gains in the long run, and risk management, which you understand yourself, basically. That's very important role and mission, I think, of private banking and wealth management. That's what we are trying to push. And for that, you need a community. You need to build a community around you, and it has to grow organically. So if you are doing the right thing, you will attract people. And we saw it ourselves, basically, when we did the first event. We had about 50 people who showed up on a Zoom call, even though we don't have anything yet. We explained to everyone that we don't have the product, we don't have the license. It's a discussion only, so it's not an investment advice. So we did a lot of disclaimers. But people are still interested, and they feel that there is a need for what we're doing. So I think that's encouraging, and that will help us grow. That's the main strategy. And that's the main value of crowdfunding experience that I see myself.
Yeah. I mean, communities are, I think you hit the nail on the head there, right? And
as you guys are moving forward, what questions are you asking and factors are you considering as you sort of continue along that growth trajectory?
We mainly try to always check with our chief product officer, ask whether the customer needs it, whether we are doing it for the customer or just because we want it ourselves. It's really important measurement, I think, because first of all, we are doing everything for the customer and we are customer-centric business as we are in sort of private banking industry. Even though we're a startup, we have to be customer-centric and we always ask that ourselves. Second of all, we always ask ourselves about the when we spend money on anything, we ask whether it's reasonable or not, whether we would have spent it if it was out of our own pocket. Because we have the fiduciary duty now to these 600 investors that invested in us. And every penny we spent, we feel responsible for that. And we want to make sure that it's invested right, in the right direction, and we get the right value out of it.
You got to be getting value out of any investment, whether it's obviously in this case, maybe a product or internal investment to move the business forward, right?
Yeah. That's what the next investors will ask us. Because if we are to raise Series A, and hopefully we will by the end of this year, the main questions will be around how did we spend the money? What did we invest in?
Totally. And you got to have your ducks in a row there. And also, I mean, you got to be open and honest, right? You have to be thinking through that process. And you quite well know to make certain you have the proper story and the proper credibility to get more investment at a point in time.
Yeah. I mean, the goal is now to get more traction. So because formally to qualify for Series A, we need to have a revenue, significant revenue, to have a sizable round. And that's the main goal. To get to that revenue as soon as possible. And both myself and my co-founder, we don't receive any salary. We agreed that we work pro bono until we raise the Series A. So,
okay. And listen, so of all the things that we've spoken about today, what's the most important piece of information that you want our listeners to understand?
I would say that if they are thinking about starting something, or having their own idea, I think it's the best time to do that now. You see in the markets, in the investment world, that now there are so many new opportunities. We are living in a time of this accelerated digital transition and in a time when there are a lot of money in the market, which needs to be put at work and invested somehow. For example, in private equity, world, we now reach the peak of the dry powder. So all the private equity funds have so much money undeployed that it has to go somewhere. And the same applies to households. They, because they cut the spending on entertainment and travel, they sit on a lot of savings and that money has to be invested somewhere. So there are a lot of money in the market and it's a question if people have enough courage to go and do it, because you have to execute, you have to start with some idea and start executing it, and then you will organically grow people, a community of people around you who believe in you, who want to invest in you, and it will grow. So that's it.
No, awesome. I mean, such great advice. I'd love all of that, not just parts of it. So, you know, thanks for that. And listen, as you wrap up the show today, how can people and our listeners get in touch with you and the guys at Force Who Wealth if they want to?
They can email me, myself. My email is quite simple, as@fortu.co.uk. They can download our app on App Store or just visit our website, fortu.co.uk. They will see a lot of information there.
Okay, great. It's been amazing. I loved our chat today and we've dived into a number of different topics. And listen, I think it'll be great to get you guys back on the show at some point in time. It sounds like you're going through a cool journey and hopefully, there's a lot of exciting things yet to come.
hopefully we will have stories to share. And thank you again for this interview. I really enjoyed it. And also I wanted to say that anyone can reach me out via LinkedIn or the Clubhouse thing, which I had started also.
Awesome.
It's getting popular, so I'm available. Thank you, guys.
Okay, awesome. Thanks, mate.
Thanks. Bye-bye.